Okay, here we go. Episode 88 of the podcast. Really special episode here. And I actually did this with a co-host who I've got with me. First co-host on the podcast. I've got Zach DelVecchio here. Big time honor. Zach and I have been friends for over a decade. A lifelong Billy Gibbons fan, as well as myself, and an absolute guitar guy. So I had to bring him into this podcast. And this has been a little bit of like a joke between us of who was going to meet Billy first, who was going to, you know, see him at dinner or something.
Well, we have so many mutual friends that all know him, but for some reason, no matter what it was, whether it was, we got to the party too late, we weren't at the event, wherever it was, for some reason, it was like this elusive white whale of always missing Billy.
We've always missed him, but I feel like it was kind of coming down to this moment. You know, my first concert was ZZ Top. It's like, look, I don't want to make such a big deal out of this, but I feel like it's kind of a big deal. We got Billy Gibbons on the podcast, an absolute legend, could not have been cooler.
One of the most outrageously incredible, nice, kind, and genuine human beings I've ever had the pleasure of speaking
This to. Was such a great episode. To hear Billy, to hear him tell these stories, to hear him from the horse's mouth about playing with Mick Jagger or Jimi Hendrix or, you know, the early days of ZZ Top. So cool. Can we say anything else? I think we just have to get into it.
Let's roll the tape.
Roll the tape. Here we go.
The Zach Kuhn Show.
What's the song that everyone plays wrong? Is there a song of yours that everyone that you always hear people play and they always get the riff wrong?
Oh yeah. Yeah, including us.
Including you.
Oh yeah. There's two things that are can be a bit irritating. Number one is when you hear a cover band doing one of your songs better than you can do it.
I don't believe that. Does that happen?
It's gone. We've seen it. And then, of course, you hit the stage and you play a couple songs, and right, it inevitably out of the front row, somebody says, "Play some Skynyrd."
Oh, no. Free Bird.
Yeah.
So I saw you, Billy. You were my first concert, ZZ Top at Jones Beach in the rain, and there was lightning behind you. And I thought it was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen.
It was quite the show. I recall it.
It was, you were on tour co-headlining with Aerosmith.
Correct.
It was an incredible night. And the thing that I just remember being, I was like 10 years old, and to see you guys dancing with the guitars, the iconic ZZ Top move, just,
yeah.
I think that was the moment I said, I have to go into the music business. I have to work in rock and roll. Where did the moves come from? Was that something that you guys had worked out, or did they kind of just happen on stage? When did the synchronized moves come to the table?
We were back in California, and this was 83, just when Eliminator was fixing to hit. And we went over to the Sony studios in Culver City, and a young lady happened to be walking down the hall, and she goes, "Oh, ZZ Top, I love you guys." It was Paula Abdul.
Oh, my God.
Who was a choreographer. She started out as a dance instructor.
Right.
And she came in and said, "I need to get you guys some moves." And we said, "Come on, bring it on." And that's really how it started. And ironically, the coincidence was later that afternoon, we took a break, walking down the hall, and I bumped into, there was a producer working down the second studio. And he said, "Man," he said, "do you know any girl singers? I've got a track and I need a girl singer." And I was standing next to Paula, and I said, "Well, Paula, why don't you step up?" She goes, "Well, I've not done this before." And I said, "Well, now's the chance." And boom, she broke up. I mean, bigger than Dallas. It was crazy. That's how it started.
Was there something kind of risky or dangerous about the little old band from Texas putting these moves in? Were people weirded out about it? Like, how did you have the confidence to put those in? It's so rock and roll now, but did it seem rock and roll then?
Well, yeah, and I got to hand it to our dearly departed bass player, Dusty Hill, dreamed up, we were working on a production, and he said, let's put some belts on stage. I said, "What kind of belts do you mean?" He said, "Something we can walk on, something that," I said, "like a moving sidewalk maybe?" He said, "Yeah, that's it. And it was actually quite fun. Until one night, we had a new operator, and he didn't know the forward and reverse shift knob, and we went flying.
That's funny. On that same note, how did it feel spinning a guitar for the first time? Because you see people throw their guitars in the air on the straps and praying that their strap locks aren't going to fly off. But it was the first time you're like, okay, let's hope this belt is not going to destroy this instrument. What was that like?
Well, Don Summers, prior to ZZ Top forming, I was in a group called the Moving Sidewalks. And we had such a blast out there right. Soon after we had gotten together as a group, we went in the studio and cut a record, 99th Floor, which started making some chart action. And following that, we got hired to join the Jimi Hendrix Experience. This was back in 1968. And he had just come over from England. But Don Summers, the bass player for the Moving Sidewalks, dreamed up the contraption that allowed... He had probably the first spinning guitar that I can recall. And later, fast forward to, again, 1983 is the release year for the Eliminator record. And we said, I called Don up and I said, hey, man, I said, can you whip up some spinning guitar for us? He said, oh, yeah, sure, man. What he didn't tell us, he was slow to remind us, hey, when you spin, you got to lean way back. And sure enough, it'll whap you in the side upside the head.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Wait, so when you were on tour with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, I think there's a story. I want to know if this is true. You covered Jimmy's songs in the set, right? You played two of his songs, Purple Haze and Foxy Lady, in the set,
yeah.
Right?
Well, we were contracted to do 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And at that time, we were so new as a band, we only knew 45 minutes worth of material if we included Foxy Lady and Purple Haze.
But why those songs? Why his songs? Isn't that poor etiquette as an opening act?
We didn't care, and neither did he. About the time we were wrapping up, Foxy Lady was the closer. And I happened to look in the shadows, and I saw this guy with his arms folded. And sure enough, we walked off stage. He grabbed me, and he said, hey, man, I want to meet you. You got a lot of nerve. It was Jimi Hendrix.
Was that the first time you met him and actually spoke with him?
Oh, yeah. It was the opening night. I think we were down in Texas, and we did, we tiptoed through Houston, Texas, Dallas, Texas, San Antonio, Texas. Then we headed out way out west, and we wound up, I followed him all the way to the West Coast, and it was quite the scene. Quite the scene.
I believe it. It was something that's so interesting. Nowadays, you know, people post online and do these things and, you know, they get global traction. But I always thought it was so amazing about yourself and ZZ Top that you'd have guys like Keith Richards. Everybody knew to come down to Texas to see you guys. How did that come about? What did you feel was that? What was generating that buzz that made everybody say, man, these are the guys. I don't care where we are. We've never even been to the United States, but we know we got to go to Texas of all places to see these guys.
Yeah. To this day... And we've all got acquaintances, we got friends, followers, fans, whatever you want to call it. We've, at some point or another, we've all crossed with these Texas gunslingers. You know, the guitar thing is a mystery. Why Texas? We don't know. We just feel it. And as you point out, well, it's funny you should mention Keith Richards. Moving Sidewalks, we remained together until 1969, and two of the Sidewalks got drafted into the military service, and I wanted to continue on, so one thing after another, we finally, I bumped into Frank Beard. He was playing the sides off the drum kit. And then, in turn, he introduced me to Dusty, and we got together. The first night we got together, I said, well, let's play a simple shuffle and see. It lasted for 3 hours, and at that moment, I said, yeah, maybe we got something. Maybe. But shortly thereafter, we wound up going to Hawaii and playing with the Rolling Stones. That's where we met.
Because Mick Jagger, because what I think what we're trying to understand is, I think it was your manager who said, we're not going to do any press
right? We're not going to go on any of the shows. We're not going to do any press. And yet everybody knew about you guys, right? Including Mick Jagger found out about you guys. Like, how does that happen? There's no social media. There's no internet at the time. How did everybody know about you guys?
Word was spreading fast. Whatever it was we were doing was hitting the streets. And, of course, word of mouth back then was it, as you point out. Way, you know, no internet. Nope. Cell phones? Are you kidding? It's just... But word of mouth was the deal. Yeah.
Okay, so Mick Jagger sees you and he brings you guys to Hawaii, right?
Yes. The promoter of that show was out of Denver, Barry Fay. And it was really interesting. I think every band on the planet was vying to get on that show. Three shows in Hawaii. We had a Friday night, a Saturday matinee, and a Saturday night. And of course... You know, they said, no, with ZZ Top, we're going to put ZZ Top and the Rolling Stones together. And, of course, we were so new and Hawaii was so remote. We were still dressed up in cowboy hats and cowboy boots. And we came out on stage. The lights came up. And I said, I heard it from the front row. They said, oh, my God, they're a country band.
That's what...
I said, no.
It's like, wait, we're more. We swear.
Yeah. Fun stuff, man.
But isn't that the, you know, choosing to wear the hats, and were you chasing a different image? As because you would have had to assume that everyone would have thought ZZ Top would have been a country band. Were you guys okay having that juxtaposition, or why the cowboy hats and why show that image?
Yeah, it was something we were raised with. One thing that I found out early on between Frank Beard, Dusty Hill, and myself, we had all listened to the Mexican Border Blaster radio late at night. And we all had such, I mean, we had been listening to blues and rhythm and blues as far as I can remember. I mean, as a youngster, that was the deal. And to gel with two other guys that had such a common background, you know, what we grew up listening to, it really put us in the fast lane. And we just picked up sticks and kept laying them down, man. It was a lot of stuff there.
Stop me if I'm wrong, but at the time too, the rhythm and blues wasn't, you know, mainstream radio at all either too. So it was kind of like when you found a person that also felt the same way, it was like, oh, I'm not alone.
Yeah, it was on its way out. It was evaporating, and which brings up kind of another interesting point of how the guys and gals in Britain rescued this vanishing art form, truly American art form. Some people, oh yeah, blues, it's so simple, three chords. But when you start digging into it, the sophistication runs so deep, so quick, it really gets it gets your pulse beating for sure. But make no mistake, the Brits really embraced it and brought it back around in such a big way. Now it's part of the fabric. It just is.
Who was the first that of all the Brits that made you say, oh man, okay, there's the sound is changing? Was it John Mayall? Was it, you know, who of that elk was the one that made you?
Jeff Beck.
The man.
Jeff Beck, yeah, man. He had put the Jeff Beck group together. In fact, the Moving Sidewalks shared a bill with the Jeff Beck group.
Really?
And again, this was about the same time Hendrix came just a little bit later. But Jeff Beck, of course, Rod Stewart was singing, Mickey Waller on drums, Nicky Hopkins on piano, and Ronnie Wood on bass.
Ronnie Wood on bass.
Oh, man, it was quite the lineup. That was, the first, the Jeff Beck group record. Those first two records are really stunning. And, you know, Jeff laughs about it today. We're still pals. I spoke to him last week. He's kind of bummed out. He's stuck over in England. And I think things are opening up as we speak. Mm-hmm. But even as close as last week, he was, oh, man, I'm trying to get back on the road, but we're stuck. But Beck was the guy that did it for me. And he was playing Gibson Les Paul at the time. Ronnie Wood was playing a reissue Fender Precision Bass. It was a copy of the 52 Precision Bass, and it was re-released in early 68 with the name Telecaster bass. But the combination of those two instruments became the backbone of ZZ Top.
And that was the inspiration for it as well? Is that what kind of made you on this hunt for, I need a Pearly Gates, I need a Les Paul, was I need to get my ox blood?
Yeah, man. And they were hard to find. The records today, there's a suspicion that Gibson produced about 1,380 of the Sunburst Les Paul, you know, the Holy Grail. But we soon found one, and we stumbled through a pawn shop in Dallas, and there was a Telecaster bass, $60 with the case. Gotta have the
with
case.
With the case included.
Yeah, man, gotta have the case. But that's, in fact, Jeff Beck was responsible for getting the first Marshall 100 watt stacks into the States. He got, we bought two stacks, Marshall 100 watt stacks, for $700.
That's insane.
It was insane. That's awesome. Yeah. He knew Jim Marshall, you know, he was good friends. He said, oh, I got some friends over.
Was that, it's funny because now the Marshall is so just associated with rock and roll because of people like yourself who bought them and played them. So we see pictures of you with Marshalls behind you, and so iconic. But at the time, was that the obvious choice of amp to get? Or was it just because Jeff Beck was pulling them in, it could have been any amp? Like, why was it the Marshall? It was the high gain and the sound, but was it the obvious amp at the time to get for what you were doing?
Yeah, there was something about the sound that was so riveting. It was inescapable. That beautiful, distorted, tube-like effect. And Jim Marshall, I got to know him much later, but he kind of shrugged it with a laugh. He kind of shrugged it off saying, well, he said, I basically copied the Fender Bassman. And Leo Fender copied he designed the Fender Bassman from the RCA catalog of 1936.
The back panel.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then he just said, here's a JTM 45. It's just a loud Bassman. Just crank it up, and had no idea or was even expecting to, you know, have tube saturation.
Yeah, but the British, the British components played a big part in distinguishing that sound. It made it so iconic, so recognizable.
Those Mullard caps, they make a difference.
Man, yeah.
On that same note, on guitars, you know, you play such an iconic vintage instrument, but you're also really known for playing kind of interesting guitars, you know, whether it's a custom shop, it's a Gibson that's modified, you know, and or even to the point where, you know, some people even say it's almost like sacrilege when you can go from a Burst to here's a guitar that has a hollowed out neck. But what's your philosophy on like a good guitar? Is it just it needs to resonate or just needs to speak to you? Or what do you look for in a guitar when you've had them all?
Well, I recount the words of our good buddy in Dallas, Texas, the late Charlie Wirtz, who founded Charlie's Guitar Shop and later started the first international guitar show based in Dallas. And he said, man, he said, I don't understand it. He said, it's just a war club. He said, meat on metal on wood. I said, yeah, that's about right. But we've got some crazy, we've just recently, we took delivery. There's a guitar builder out of Boise, Idaho, been at it since, I guess, he goes back early 80s. John Bolin.
Of course. You've been working with him for years.
Bolin guitars, yeah. And there's nothing that he's not afraid to do. You can throw anything you want, the most kind of irrational, unreasonable suggestion, and he'll embrace it. Oh, yeah, let's try it.
He did that arch top once that had the individual pieces of the red and white maple in a circle spiral. That is, I still think, one of the most amazingly designed-looking instruments.
Yes, and he did the I said, can you make me a Fender Esquire? He said, well, I can make an Esquire, something like it. He said, why don't you call up Fender? They'll send you one. I said, you could do something a little bit different. And here it is. Sure enough, he honeycombed the body.
That's awesome.
And it is so comfortable. It's with the removal, every unnecessary scrap of sawdust has been eliminated. This thing weighs, it's like a Martin acoustic guitar, fully loaded.
And I bet it resonates really well, too. Like,
yeah, man, it'll float out of your hand. It's so light. It's crazy.
What's the weirdest guitar you've ever designed? Was there something that was just so weird that it just didn't work out, or did you always stick the landing?
There was a guy in Germany who released a guitar called the Teufel Birdfish.
Yes, with the tone bars.
With the tone bars. Mm-hmm. Very fascinating instrument. Yeah. Strange to look at, but easy to play. And the sound, those interchangeable tone bars, really did a number with it. Yeah, Teufel.
Yeah, he's talking about, it's like him and Ritter were like two out in Europe that were totally saying, we don't care what a guitar used to look like. We're going to design it like a modern sports car and modern art at the same time.
There was a guy sent me a picture just this morning. A British design team, Brian Eastwood and his son Michael Eastwood, and they came up with...
Oh, cool.
They came up with a real interesting design.
Oh, wow. Kind of, it's like a little bit of a Bo Diddley looking thing.
It's a Bo Diddley Washburn.
Yeah, the Billy Bo meets the UK madness. They call it the Billy Bird.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's the process? And correct me if I'm wrong. I've heard that maybe like every 2 years or so, you guys will go through and do new guitars and you'll make sure everything matches where it's supposed to, bass and guitar. What's the process for that? How do people send you stuff? Do you go out and sort of pick colors and designs and put everything together? How's that happen?
Yeah, well, once we found a home with Boland Guitars out of Idaho, Boise, Idaho, knowing that John understood the value of preserving what he called the ZZ Top sounding guitar.
What is that? Can you describe that? What is the...
Well, it's modeled after the 59 Les Paul, which we've had.
Pearly Gates. The guitar.
Yes. And now we call it the Backstage Science Project.
When do you play Pearly Gates? Do you play it on the road? Because do you bring it out with you?
Occasionally? Yeah. It got to be so valuable. And we nearly lost. Two guys came backstage and were stopped at the backstage door, fortunately, as with Pearly in hand.
Oh, man.
But we came close. But ever since then, we decided to study Pearly and put it under the microscope. We evaluated the EQ performance. We pretty much figured out what was going on under the hood, which and someone said, what possibly made Pearly such an outstanding instrument? Luck. It was simple, just a stroke of luck. The right combination of wood, the right amount of glue, the right amount of lack of humidity in the spray booth, all those, you know, you take a production line and why is it that the, call it the Les Paul production line, at the end of the day, you've got 10 or 12 guitars looking pretty much the same, but sounding way, way different. It's because no two trees grow alike. The cellular structure is just, you know.
Right, of course, yeah.
As wide as the range can get. So there you have it. It's the nightmare for guitar makers that get lucky one day on Monday, and by Friday they're still searching to get it the same.
Well, especially for 59s, where they have such a, you know, reverence. But you know, and you've played infinitely more than I have, but I played dozens of them, and some of them are dogs. Some of them are just really okay. And then you find those ones, like Gary Rosington's Burst I played not too long ago. Amazing. Not even because it was his or anything like that. It was just a great Les Paul. But when you find those ones, all you do is you hit that A chord or G chord, and you're like, yep, I don't need to know anything else. I just know this guitar works.
Yeah. There is a interesting work. It's a book entitled The Guitars from Japan. And I think really the zenith of Japanese guitar making reached its first peak in the 60s. You had Tysco, Goya, Greco, so many names. There was literally hundreds of electric guitars coming out of Japan. And, you know, just when you think that you could wipe the slate clean and say, oh, no, those things were not even playable. Wrong. now the $160 solid body is now $1,060.
Well, you try to find those old Bernies or the Ibanez lawsuits, and they're as much as a standard Gibson is.
Yeah,
nowadays.
Man, it's pretty wild. And the fact is, Hartley Peavy, I was speaking with Hartley Peavy down in Mississippi, and he said, come on out to the back. And I said, yeah. And sure enough, there were two semis leaving the property at the end of the day. He said, I make this stuff, and it leaves the building every day. Where is it going? And it's never ending. It's been, you know, like, what are we looking at, 50 plus years of, but as the old saying goes, one's too many and 100 ain't enough.
Especially when it comes to guitars.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, so I cut you off. So we were saying, so when you're pairing guitars for tours, so you'll go and your guitar maker kind of knows what the ZZ Top guitar is. And is he the one who's doing the color palettes and mixing and matching? Or how involved are you in deciding what everything is going to look like on stage guitar-wise?
Mr. Boland allows me into the design studio at the drop of a hat. He actually prefers the challenge when something odd and unexpected lands in his lap. But he's a great guy to work with, and we'll sit behind the drawing board. On a good day, we'll knock something out in 10 minutes. On the other day, hey, you're going to have to fly to Las Vegas to finish this out. Okay, fine. I'll be there. So it's always something. It's a great working relationship, you know. The creative process is endless. And to find somebody that's always willing to pick up the sticks and lay them down for you, it's pretty cool.
Which ones do you have coming down the pipeline that you could talk about right now?
We just sent off, last week I was in, or 2 weeks ago I was in Las Vegas. And we were wrapping up the ZZ Top residency at the Venetian. Beautiful room.
Yeah.
It's a great, great spot. And late, not starting until midnight, we were off the deck at 10:30. Down the street at Danny Coker's joint, Counts Customs.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a neat little nightclub, The Vamp.
I didn't know that.
And Gilby Clark, he was with Guns N' Roses for the longest time. Now he's got a great, wicked trio, Gilby Clark Trio. They were playing at The Vamp. So we got off stage and hauled across town. And Gilby is famous. He's noted for favoring the Zamatis guitar, the work of Tony Zamatis from the UK. He passed away. Tony Zamatis passed away in 2002, but his youngster decided to keep the flame alit and licensed the manufacturing to a high-end Japanese outfit, and they actually got better. Yeah, you could spend up to $15,000-$20,000 for one of Tony's originals. The current production still in place is very reasonable. In fact, here in Nashville, I went across town to see Walter Carter, Carter's mm-hmm. Vintage, and he had not one, but two.
Oh, man.
Interesting Zamatis.
And you know what? Those are reasonable. They're like $900.
Yes.
Right? They're really reasonable.
Quite affordable. And yet, I couldn't keep my hands off of it. I sent it to Boland. I said, we're going to remove the toggle switch, take two knobs out. We're going to add binding.
So you got it. You bought the guitar.
Bought both of them.
You bought both of them. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I saw those online, actually, and I was eyeing those, and I said, those things are badass. Yeah. Like, Billy Gibbons beat me to it.
Oh, man.
I'm glad you have them because, you know, one of the best parts about watching you is seeing what guitar you're playing. That's just as fun as watching you, is seeing what you've got around your neck. Billy, before we run out of time, we have to talk about the new album, Hardware, which just came out, which I think is a great record. And I think the guitars on, I think if it's even possible, there's more guitars on this than like a ZZ Top record. Being the Billy Gibbons solo record, does that allow you to put more guitars on it? Can you spread out a little bit and be even more guitar heavy, if that's even a thing? What was this like?
Yeah, definitely. And it was an angle that was bolstered by one of Nashville's great recording engineers, Mike Fiorentino. I love his last name, Fiorentino. Tiny Flowers.
That's a good one.
Yeah, Mike Fiorentino. And I got a phone call from another Guns N' Roses stalwart, Matt Sorum, on drums. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm sitting here in Las Vegas. Like everybody else, we've kind of been stuck, you know?" He said, "Well, I found a recording studio in Joshua Tree." I said, "No kidding." I said, "I've worked out there with Queens of the Stone Age. Josh had me come out." He said, "No, it's another studio." I said, "You mean there's two in Joshua Tree? It's not that big." Yeah, the whole desert.
Yeah.
But sure enough, it was right across the highway. And Austin Hanks, our trusted left-handed guitar player, I can't even look at Austin playing.
Freaks me
out. Upside down and backwards. I mean, it's, and with a weird tuning on top of it, with a capo.
I mean, it's
bizarre. But that brought about, we actually went out there to inspect the studio. And of course, we made no provisions for an equipment truck to follow us. We were just thinking, okay, 30 minutes, you walk through a studio, four walls, no windows, great. But as luck would have it, the engineers insisted that Matt pick up some drums and Austin got a guitar. They had a Fender Jazzmaster, a Fender Jaguar from 1966, going through a Fender reverb tank into a tweed a Fender bassman. And it was all hardwired. You couldn't unplug anything. Everything was, guitars were hardwired into the reverb, which was hardwired into the amp.
Fascinating.
And I said, "Well, you know, let's make some noise." And the sound of the surf guitar was back. And listen closely to, well, the opening number, the first track that was cut was a thing we wrote called West Coast Junkie. I'm a West Coast junkie from a lonesome Texas town. But there it was. The surf guitar was back.
What a cool sound.
It was crazy.
Spring reverb tanks like that.
Yeah, man. And that was the impetus that led the release of Hardware to be such a guitar-driven record. We loved it.
It really is. I think everybody's got to go listen to this record because I was putting it on and it's like a ZZ Top record with more guitar. And you get to take your solos are kind of, and you're really getting the changes in a couple places also. In a couple moments, you're really hitting. I think it's a great record. Everybody's got to listen to it. Hardware. And your new tequila line, Tres Hombres.
The tequila is Pura Vida.
The tequila is Pura Vida.
And now we've introduced a ZZ Top whiskey, Tres
Hombres.
It's
a whiskey. Excuse me. It's a whiskey.
Yeah.
Called, which is three types of what's in it. There's three different ingredients in it, right? What is this?
Well, for your listeners and viewers, I would encourage somebody to get industrious and go online and look up Balcones Whiskey. That's the parent company, the distillery, that volunteered to try and experiment with some new blends. You know, it really comes down to, does it taste good? Does it feel good? It is good. But Balcones, it's Balcones. Named after the famous fault line that runs through the state of Texas, Balcones Fault. Yeah.
Okay, everybody's got. Are you a big a whiskey snob? I guess that might not be the right word, but are you particular about your whiskeys?
I may become that.
You may become that with your own. Now that you have your own line, you might have to become very particular with your whiskeys.
With the release of Tres Hombres from Balcones Distillery.
I just want to try just the name alone. I got to give this thing a try.
Sure enough.
I just love whiskey, so
yeah,
I don't have to be provoked.
Oh, man. Okay. Look, in our final moment together, Zach, what you got? What you got? What's been unsaid?
I have a request for you. As of things that I think you need to consider as you're branching things out, there's been two people in my entire life that have inspired fashion. Jimmy Page in his dragon suit and you with the nudie suits. Ooh. And I think it's time to introduce a fashion line of your jackets. The world needs them.
Could it happen,
Billy? I need them.
Could there be a Billy Gibbons fashion line?
Why not?
Right.
You know, we got saddled up with Nudie back in the start of ZZ Top. We were looking for something, and my buddy Chris Hillman was playing in the Birds and then the Flying Burrito Brothers, and the whole West Coast cowboy movement was taking off. Sweetheart of the Rodeo and Flying Burrito Brothers. It was actually my dad who was the orchestra leader. He did so much, but the founders of the Corral Club, which was the big part of the Houston Fat Stock Show and Rodeo, which is still one of the biggest in the country. And Howard Lee, who was married to Jean Tierney, he came to my dad and he said, "Freddie," he said, "we need the Gibbons touch." He said, "We all show up in business suits and it's just not right for the rodeo. What do you got?" He said, "Well, there's a guy out there in North Hollywood. I know him quite well. His name is Nudie Kahn." So Nudie flew to Houston, and Glenn McCarthy, who owned the Shamrock Hotel, which is the movie Giant, was probably based around the life of Glenn McCarthy. This guy was way out there. James Dean, of course, played Jet Rink, who was not so loosely based on Glenn McCarthy. It was Glenn McCarthy. But Glenn put Nudie up at the Shamrock Hotel, and in 2 weeks, I think Nudie took orders for like 300 suits.
Oh, my God.
You know, smile pockets, arrowheads, this was just a little bit before the rhinestone introduction. We'll have to talk about that at a later date.
Yes.
What's the rhinestone? Was that when you guys started? How did that come together?
Well, Nudie was married to one of two twin girls. They had a daughter, and she fell in love with a guy from Mexico. And Nudie was a little skittish. He said, "I don't know. I don't know anything about Mexico." He said, "I don't know if this is going to work," until he found out that this guy from Mexico came from a long line of tailors in Mexico. He said, "Okay,
keeping it in the family.
Yeah, it's part of the family." But it was Manuel Cuevas, who introduced rhinestones. In addition, you had Ben the Turk up in Philadelphia. Nudie, who was actually immigrated from Russia, came to New York. He got his nickname. He was making costumes for the burlesque dancers in New York. Then he came, of course, relocated to North Hollywood right there on Lancashire Boulevard, started making all the fashion costumes. Roy Rogers, all the cowboy guys had them. And the rest is history.
Wow. Okay, in our final moments together, Billy, I just wanted to ask, you know, some of these songs are so iconic. The solos are so iconic. The riffs are so iconic. Song like LaGrange, you know, that you're so well known for, when you're recording the solo to LaGrange today, it feels almost like classical music in the sense that kids are sitting down, they learn it note for note for note. Were you composing these and stressing over that these were going to become, that the licks and the solos were going to be immortalized, or did you just kind of play them? Were they just kind of improvised in the spot?
Yeah, right on the spot. It was improvisation from square one. And that was the genius of what Frank and Dusty provided, was this solid rhythm section. And I just had to show up and it was there. And with something so solid to work across, it just comes out. Just comes out. Of course, we had Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, Keith Richards, Eric Clapton, Mick Abrams, Peter Green, Jeremy Spencer. We had so many of those British guys influencing everything we heard. It was not too much of a stretch to emulate. And I think that's when the door opened, and improvising to this day is it's the creative outlet. It's the shout.
It's the, I think our producer, Mike, you got a question?
Sure.
You got a question?
Quick question. Here we go.
Okay. So I'm going to preface this by saying that I'm not a musician. I'm not in the music industry, really. I'm in the film industry. But growing up, I loved music. I was obsessed with Elvis Presley, and I got the tattoo to prove it. But one of my most recent, like, kind of big achievements that was not career related was I was in Memphis. I went to Graceland, and I got to be interviewed on Elvis Radio and, you know, get to play a song, whatever. But it was such a big kind of personal achievement because I grew up listening to Elvis Radio, and it came, it was this full circle moment. And I'm just wondering, do you have something in your life that is not music related, that is very personal to you, that, that a 7-year-old Billy would be so excited to hear that you finally, you know, achieved in your life?
I could relate to so many elements just sprang to mind. Starting with Elvis, I got to see Elvis when I was 5.
Oh man.
Live and up close. My mom took me to me and my little sister got to see Elvis. And then, what really solidified it, 2 years later, my dad put me in the car. I was 7. He said, "Hey, we're going to the recording studio. I've got some business to take care of." He said, when we arrived, we walked in, he put me in a chair and he said, "I want you to sit here. You can be quiet." He said, "There's a band going to make a record." It turned out to be B.B. King and his orchestra.
Oh my.
I got to see. And they recorded a song called "I'm Tired of Your Jive." And 50 years later, B.B. King was being celebrated by a group of musicians. They were putting a CD together, a tribute to B.B. King, with him performing with a host of different entertainers. And I showed up at the studio. I got invited to be on the record. And B.B. said, "Do you know the song we're going to do today?" I said, "Yes, sir. Yes, I know. I'm Tired of Your Jive." I said, "I was there when you recorded it." He goes, "No, that was 1957. I said, "I was there." He said, "You're the little boy sitting in the chair." Yeah.
That was crazy.
Cool is that? That's like, and there was a guy originally, early on in the ZZ Top days, there was a gig you guys played where one guy was in the audience, and you made him stay, and you bought him drinks, and he'll still come around to ZZ Top shows every now and then.
Yeah,
right?
we just know him as the guy.
He won't give you his name.
No,
he's
this mysterious guy. He said, "Hey, man, I'm here. I was the one guy that the curtains opened, and we looked out, and there was one paying customer." And we went ahead and played the show, took a break, bought him a Coke.
No way.
He still comes around.
Zach, any final questions here in our final moments? Anything else? What have we left out?
I think now that you're officially a resident of Nashville, is there anything in Nashville? Is there the music scene? Is there anything that you want to start picking up or trying to adventure down?
Yeah, you know, I've got so many friends that either work in the studios or travel the country. I've recently made friends quite close with a guy that's a blaze, Guthrie Trapp.
He's actually a very good friend
of
both of
ours.
Wow. I spoke to him yesterday.
That guy needs to practice or something. He's not. It's, you know, it's funny because I was in Green Guitars with him a couple weeks ago and we were upstairs and he was playing guitars and then he was passing me guitars. I was like, "Don't pass me these guitars." After he just picks anything up. He sounds so good.
Yeah. I recently performed at the Grand Ole Opry.
Right, of course. That was a big event.
And the producer of the show said, "Is there anybody that you could think of that you'd like to see on the show?" And I said, "Well, I'd really like to invite Guthrie Trapp." And he said, I've heard about Guthrie Trapp, the wizard on just blazing guitar." I said, "Yeah, that's Guthrie." He said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to play drums."
Said, that's right. You were playing the snare drum on that.
Yeah, man.
And it was improvised because Guthrie was saying that you just kind of told him, "Go on stage and be like, play something." And yeah, you started playing a groove, right?
Yep. Yep.
But do you look at a player like Guthrie and does that push you to, I guess, practice? Or are you, do you get, does he ever show you licks or anything? You show him licks. And, you know, when you're around a player like that, do you feel like you're still improving as a player, or is your thing now, let me just be the best Billy Gibbons that I can be?
Well, he's very inspirational, and to be in his presence when he's performing is a real eye-opener. And you leave, first of all, you're scratching your head going, how do you do that? Then you wind up going straight to the woodshed and say, I'm going to try it.
So when you see a great guitar player, that still excites you to go home and practice and pick up a guitar and play. That still excites you to get in there and work on it.
Definitely. Yeah, it's still an ignition point. There's something about it that hasn't faded. I mean, it's the groove. It's the grind.
Okay, final question here. Favorite Mexican food in Nashville? Do you have a spot?
Several.
Really?
Several. Yeah. There's one on 12th, Bar Taco.
You know what? Let me tell you something, Billy.
Okay, here we go.
We're in the real part. Let me tell you something, Billy. In a high debate about
I said to Zach, what if Billy said Bar Taco?
He actually did say
I thought there was no way you were going to say Bar Taco. Is that a spot that you really like, actually?
I was there yesterday afternoon. I'll probably be there again today.
Really? Yeah. This to me seems to. I love Bar Taco, but I feel like it's not. Would you consider it authentic?
Yes. When they brought out elotes, which is shaved corn right off the cob with a little bit of Parmesan, and they've got something to bind it that is right out of Mexico. It's the real deal.
I've never had that there, so that's what I have to get.
Yeah, man.
And I think the guacamole is great, and the round chips are good.
Well, our next hour is going to be fashion and food.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The next segment. I'm down.
Fantastic.
Folks, you got to join us. We'll be at Bar Taco, and that'll be our starting point.
Yes. And then give us one more, and then we'll let you go. But you said you had a couple. Just give us one or two more.
Super Rica.
That's my favorite in town. I think it's amazing.
It's cool.
It's real cool, and it's good. It's really good.
Kind of hard to find, but that makes it
really good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. We've got Billy, can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. This was such a thrill. We are such lifelong guitar players. Like I said, my first concert was ZZ Top. He's been listening to ZZ Top forever.
I learned to pinstripe because of you.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, he's good at it, too. He's really good at it.
Z and Z. It's you know.
This is it. But yeah, thank you so much. I mean, so much time spent trying to learn your record. So this is very cool. Thanks for taking the time.
Very cool. Done deal. Bueno, bueno.
There you have it, Billy Gibbons on the podcast. And, you know, man, I wish we actually kept the microphones rolling because we ended up talking for like another hour afterwards. Just the coolest guy. Thanks again to Zach Delvecchio for co-hosting this episode with me. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com. Or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. The Zach Kuhn Show is part of the American Songwriter Podcast Network, and we're proud to be part of it. It's a great network with some really great shows. Check it out. And that's it. I think that's it. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.